Hello and welcome to Future Building. I'm Matthew Aitchison and I'm Professor at Monash University and CEO of Building 4.0 CRC. In this podcast, we take a broad look at buildings and building in contemporary society and what's coming down the pipeline in the future. We'll talk with invited guests and experts in the field, where we'll cover news and trends along with research and developments in the industry. Future Building is proudly sponsored by Building 4.0 CRC. If you're a listener to the Future Building podcast, then it's almost certain that you'll have heard us use the term prefab, modular, offsite, or even perhaps modern methods of construction and the many other terms we use for the industrialization of building. In my words, I think that means making building more like a manufacturing industry and less like the traditional construction industry. Those who know a little more about history of building would know that the wider project of industrialization of building has been underway since the early 19th century. Let's say it started around 200 years ago. The arguments for a more industrialized mode of building are numerous, and efforts over the past years have been countless. And yet, in all but a few countries, the prefab, modular, or offsite industry is not scaled up to become the normal mode of building. Why? Well, this is the question that's at the heart of our interview today and also at the report at its centre. Today, I've got the pleasure of interviewing Professor Ivan Rupnik. I first met Ivan over two decades ago as he was embarking on his PhD at Harvard, and our paths have continued to cross ever since then. In 2018, Ivan and his business partner, Ryan Smith, contributed to a book project that we were working on called Prefab Housing and the Future of Building. That's a book that focused on many of the issues that we'll go on to discuss today as well. To Ivan, he is Associate Professor of Architecture at Northeastern University, and he's also founding partner at ModX. ModX is based in the US and is very relevant to this story because it's a consultancy, advocate and facilitator for industry and government with a focus on research into offsite construction. ModX was founded by Ivan and Ryan Smith, and they were later joined by Tyler Schmetter as managing partner. ModX organizes tours, educational courses, and they also advocate for the industry, and they carry out commissioned research, which is what we're going to get into today. The patch of research he'll focus on today is for the US Department of Housing and Urban Development, which is also known as HUD. And for those who have studied the history of novel housing programs, HUD is a very well-known name. As far back as the 1960s and 70s, with Operation Breakthrough, the US government and HUD sought to completely generate a new paradigm for housing. HUD have continued to look at housing through a more industrialized lens, and today we'll move to examine some of the work that ModX and Ivan and his colleagues have collaborated on in this area. In the piece of research we're looking at specifically today and into which we go into some detail is a report published by HUD in January 2023, and it's titled Offsite Construction for Housing, a Research Roadmap. As the foreword to the report outlines, it is intended to be an industry-wide roadmap for identifying the topics and questions for which the housing and offsite construction sectors can focus their research and development efforts. There are so many really fascinating things in this conversation. I really struggle to outline them all, but I would say our discussion of Operation Breakthrough was fantastic. A further discussion of the so-called HUD code, and particularly ending towards our discussion of demand aggregation and the necessity for regulatory harmonization, I think is really insightful and instructive for many of the big problems we're facing today. I really hope you enjoy this interview with an old colleague of mine, Ivan Rupnik. I spoke with Ivan from his holiday home in Croatia in May 2025. Ivan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Matthew. Nice to be here.
Great to see you again. I have to say at the outset of this, Ivan, it's always great to chat with you because we've been catching up sporadically over the last 20 years. And every time you and I catch up, I always feel like I have a massive boost in learning. And so I'm really happy that today we can share one of our conversations with our wider audience of the podcast. So thanks again for coming.
No problem.
Ivan, you obviously wear a few hats. We've heard a little bit about that in the introduction. You're a professor at Northeastern University in Boston, and you're also founding partner at ModX with Ryan Smith and Tyler Schmetterer. Can you tell us a little bit about your work at both of those organizations and how they fit together?
Well, that's a great question, and one I have to explain often to both both of those entities. So maybe to talk about ModX first. So we're a research-based advisory group. We work with industry and with government, and we try to kind of move the needle forward in terms of innovative industrialized construction. We're involved in both education, advising, and I guess research, in different formats. And then Northeastern, I'm a professor of architecture, and I try to bring that research into studio-based learning as well as course-based learning, and really try to change the studio pedagogy, honestly, to teach a different kind of design, to be honest. That's the most challenging part, is reforming the studio curriculum to work around more of a product-based approach as opposed to a project-based approach.
Excellent. In preparation for this, I learned a few things about you, or perhaps relearned a few things about you that I might have forgotten over the last 20 years. In terms of your background in architecture, you started at Louisiana State, and then you went on to do an MArch at Harvard. And then obviously you completed your PhD at Harvard with our mutual friend, Eve Blau. Ivan, I've seen you present aspects of your work a few times over the years, and I always think it's a really dense piece of work that you keep drawing new insights from. In rereading the abstract in preparation for today, just one of the phrases caught my eye again in a slightly different light. And it was when you were speaking about, and I'm quoting here, the laboratory method and visualization theory of scientific management. Now, you and I both know that this is a reference back to Frederick Taylor's concept of scientific management. But can you maybe just give us an insight into how your early work and the work in the PhD informs your work today with ModX and elsewhere?
Yeah, I can try to do that quickly, but it's interesting because the PhD work, so I was before I started the PhD work, because when I was working with Eve Blau, we were looking at sort of the architecture and urbanism of Zagreb, which is my hometown, and there was a really interesting prefab company that worked in former Yugoslavia, and it just didn't make sense how they could produce so many housing units so efficiently and using pretty advanced materials. And the technologies didn't really explain it. And really, it was the design tools. And the design tools were tools that looked like what you would see on the cover of an Edward Tufte book. So they were drawings that the cosmonauts used to plan trips to space. and they were really, really truly space-time drawings that these architects, not engineers, were using to plan, you know, really units. And I had the fortune of working with an architect who's now who's passed, Bogdan Budimirov, and he really taught me how to read these very complicated space-time drawings, and that led me to do the dissertation. And so I went back from actually followed where he got those tools, which is, you know, it was interesting enough, was Kiev back in the 60s. Kiev was the center of prefab sort of innovation in the Soviet Union, not Moscow. And then that went back to Germany in the interwar period and people like Gropius and Ernst May. And then that went back to really the US, but not architecture so much, but these kind of management consultants. And that led to these studies of like the laboratory method, which is really the idea that a factory was the right place to do research and to, you know, apply that research as opposed to an institute or a lab or even the best practices from tradition. That was the strange process where I described my dissertation as sort of like studies of, you know, of perspective drawings. So I wanted to really understand how these drawings that were so powerful at managing space-time issues in practice to a level that, you know, you would in architecture use plans and sections for, and how do they develop and where do they come from? And so my dissertation was really looking back and seeing how the tools that made post-war large prefab systems possible can go all the way back to sort of the turn of the century. And people like Frederick Taylor, Henry Gantt, who developed the Gantt chart. And then really my favorite characters were Frank and Lillian Gilbreth, who came from construction and also from psychology and moved into this kind of visualization.
Wow. Well, I wasn't kidding when I said it was a dense dissertation full of ideas. And I've had the pleasure of seeing a presentation that you gave to our lab. I think it was probably about 8 years ago in Sydney now. And one of the things that really interested me about those space age drawings that you're referring to was how they managed to coordinate these massive programs of buildings using these kinds of drawings and sort of, in my world, and I'm probably not doing this justice, Ivan, was this sort of forerunner to a spreadsheet and effectively a whiteboard type disposition of, materials, time and space and things like that. And it really rang home to me watching that presentation back then about how a lot of the, I'm going to say, for the purposes of this interview, the hype that we were experiencing back then around technology and its uses and very sophisticated digital platforms. Of course, all of that stuff is great. But here we had people and companies doing all of this stuff completely analog and generating way, way, way more housing than any of the companies we've seen who've chosen to jump on the technology railroad tracks. That was a real insight for me back then. Did I get that right, or am I way off?
Yeah, no, you did. Yeah, and it feels like a different life because that felt very academic. I enjoyed those studies. And really, after visiting you in Australia, things changed. We can talk about that. And all of a sudden, actually, really thanks to Ryan Smith, who's also a researcher, but who had learned how to make these things relevant to industry. What's been shocking is how these stories and these insights and these really beautiful drawings and these fantastic histories that I think you and I, from a different part of our careers, enjoyed, all of a sudden became very relevant. And that's been honestly the biggest shock of my career, is that these things that I really enjoyed studying because I like studying things that interest me have become so relevant. I would have never guessed that.
That's fantastic. And I think for anyone listening who might be from a research background or perhaps even a PhD or a postdoc, I think what Ivan's just said there is one of the real joys of doing research, is that oftentimes you start out on a path, but you actually don't know where it's going to lead you. And the kind of serendipity that you've just described there, I think is really important, Ivan. Look, I want to move on to the next part of our interview now, which is, you explained a little bit about ModX and what you guys are up to there, the advocacy, the advisory, and the research. And many listeners who are familiar with ModX and your work would also know these fabulous tours that you guys organize. But I specifically want to dive a bit deeper into the work you've been doing with the US Department of Housing and Urban Development, which many of us know and love as the acronym HUD. Now, as I understand it, you've been collaborating with HUD over the last couple of years around some research that looks at the potential use of prefab modular and offsite for HUD housing projects, and in particular, trying to solve the problem of affordable housing. Before we get into that work, Ivan, I do think it's important for our international listeners and indeed some people that may never have heard of HUD before to explain what is HUD and why it is significant. Could you maybe say a few words about what HUD is and where it sits in the history of all of this stuff?
Yeah, so I mean, for international listeners, and this is research we were doing for HUD to contextualize it, HUD is a Ministry of Housing. It's not a Ministry of Construction. There really is no Ministry of Construction equivalent in the US like there are in many European countries. It was actually founded in the mid-60s, so it's not that old. And it was really from day one really actually closely related to the history of prefabrication or offsite construction. In fact, probably more so at its founding, and probably more so again now. So that's just a very brief. Oh, and one important thing is the Federal Housing Administration, which precedes HUD, which is the agency that sort of guarantees a lot of the mortgages and some of the housing finance in the U.S., is part of HUD. So that's a very important part of HUD. and there's other aspects of HUD. HUD is research. It also oversees a very large federal program for a certain kind of prefabricated housing that it has overseen since 1976. And I would argue probably one of the few federally funded run housing programs in prefabrication that is actually on a cost level, produce the kind of dream of a factory built home that's, dollar for dollar, or unit per unit. It's about they claim about, and they deliver 50% savings compared to comparable housing in certain markets and certain housing types. And about 9 million housing units have been delivered under that HUD program. So pretty successful program.
Yeah, I want to come back to that particular program, but given that both you and I have studied history, we're going to do that chronologically, Ivan. So I thought it would be interesting for our listeners to introduce Operation Breakthrough. What was it? What did it deliver? And why should we care about Operation Breakthrough today?
Well, so Operation Breakthrough was kind of the founding program of HUD. It only really started after a few years after the agency was founded. And so Operation Breakthrough was a kind of a research and demonstration project. It was not a housing program. There was so the U.S. had a essentially a major housing program in 1968 set up, where there was a goal by Congress to build 26 million housing units in 10 years, which is quite a lot. And as a way to not just meet but exceed demand for housing at the time, and to stabilize housing costs. And they had realized very quickly that it was literally impossible to build that many units with the same materials, labor, and land. And there was an understanding that there would need to be a change in the project delivery and production. And so Congress allotted a certain portion of money from that larger housing program to HUD to do a couple of things to help create a what they called a high technology housing sector from existing companies, but also to bring people like General Electric or Boeing into the housing space. And really, one of the other research goals was to demonstrate the cost of a fragmented regulatory environment on innovative construction. And so the funding HUD received for Operation Breakthrough was less about building units. They did build about 3,000 units, but it gets confused by, it sounds like the goal is building units. Like, no, the goal, it was really a demonstration and research project that was supposed to confirm the need for structural reforms in the U.S. framework in order to create a sector that could then ultimately meet this much higher production. And quality also, by the way, that ultimately was the goal of a bigger housing program that had really nothing to do directly with Operation Breakthrough. But the fact that those two were conflated, a housing program and a research program, has meant that there's been a lot of misunderstanding of what Operation Breakthrough was and wasn't. So it Operation Breakthrough was tasked to define the cost of a fragmented regulatory environment to innovation. They ran that program. They got the numbers. Congress said, "You are right." In 1974, they passed policy affirming that. And then, unfortunately, other things happened. That housing program was prematurely canceled before it was completed. And then, worse off, there was 25 very innovative companies that were generated through that program, all of which had invested outside of the program and increased capacity capability. Then the affordable housing pipeline disappeared in 1973, 6 months before a war in the Middle East and our first global energy crisis. And guess what? There was an extinction event. All 25 companies disappeared. And a lot of the policy recommendations around regulatory change and financing and contracts and all the things that really make these technologies work just never got realized. But some things did get realized, and we can talk about those. But that's the Operation Breakthrough, again, was a research project. It was a demonstration project for people that enjoy history. The closest thing, in Weimar Germany, there was a program from 1925 to 1929 that included four sites in Germany that was very much that sort of grandfather to this thinking, which is really, again, building some units, but building the units to really test, verify, create metrics, and then create policy change.
Excellent, excellent, excellent summary. Thank you for that, Ivan. And it kind of, in many ways, sets up an answer to my next question, which I'm jumping ahead now. We're going to get to the work you've done with HUD on your research roadmap. But in that, I wanted to mention that you had recommended a comprehensive review of Operation Breakthrough. I feel like I know the answer to that now, but is there any other, are there any other artifacts lying in the ashes of Operation Breakthrough that you'd want to pull out for us now?
Well, there's two. One is that the Japanese were developing their own sort of offsite construction acceleration program in the 60s, and they had all kinds of problems that are worth discussing too. And they sent a delegation during Operation Breakthrough, and they really liked the one innovation, which they called and HUD called housing system certification, which was essentially saying, we can't change the regulatory environment, the building code overnight. So what we're going to do is we're going to create pathways for innovative companies to get around our current regulatory environment and to create little like bubbles of regulation that would allow them, if they're willing to do kind of upfront work to certify their housing system in its entirety, HUD would help them to navigate local codes, which were not at all set up for that. And that story is really interesting because while Operation Breakthrough proved out its goals, wasn't fully applied, although it did have an impact in the US. It was very impactful, not the only factor, but very impactful in the Japanese evolution of their regulatory environment. So in a way, you have a kind of parallel history of what if, where in Japan, the Japanese did a lot of very innovative things on their own, not saying it all came from this Operation Breakthrough program, but they definitely got sort of validation from that program and then applied it with great success to an industry which I would say, and you probably agree, is one of those countries where we can really see what kind of innovative industrialized offsite construction can do at scale. And so that's what's been really interesting is to be able to show that to policymakers in the US and say, look, these policies that seem like they're somewhat old have played out and proven out. And we don't need to reinvent the wheel. I mean, a lot of our work has been saying, let's do one step back, two steps forward. Let's look at those policies because one, they've worked in other countries. Two, it's how we regulate every other manufacturing sector in the US.
Really fascinating story as well, and I think it's so interesting that I've noticed oftentimes in our industry, particularly being based in Australia myself, we can get locked in the Anglosphere and forget that other countries and there are other traditions and innovations that have been achieved, and obviously the Japanese contribution to this area has been enormous. Am I right in saying, and this is my next question, then, that one of those bubbles that you just described would be the HUD code itself, Ivan? And perhaps you could talk us through what that HUD code is. You foreshadowed some of that before, but what's customarily known as HUD code? Can you give us a bit of an overview
Well, since you like history, and I think it's relevant here, the HUD code. So
of
the
that?
uh,
You're right, I do like
well, so
history.
Operation Breakthrough was focused on really looking at how to make a more conducive regulatory environment for all forms of housing delivery, and really, reform building codes and all kinds of other things en masse. Interestingly enough, already in the US, the mobile home sector, which grew out of the recreational vehicle sector, was quite strong. So, in tandem with Operation Breakthrough, one in four housing units in the US were already mobile homes. They were, but they were very cheap. They fell outside of any kind of building code because they were seen as temporary, but they were very low quality and they were literally dangerous. So a state like New Mexico, for example, as much as like 50% of housing was mobile homes in the early 70s. And it just got worse as the housing crisis got worse. So really, the HUD code, which is again, I'll say what it is, but HUD code genesis was that actually all this innovation that happened with Operation Breakthrough didn't really get applied. A housing crisis and an energy crisis and economic crisis hit the U.S. like never before, and we got Mad Max out of it in Australia, thanks to it too. Just to contextualize it from outside, and I think it fits the the vibe and in many places. But so there was a serious housing crisis. There was life safety issues with mobile homes being used for permanent housing. And what happened was that, interestingly, we did the research for HUD as well. Is that really U.S. Congress, certain people, certain Congress, congressional folks from states that were having that were dependent on mobile homes, but also were having issues with them, came to HUD and said, what can you do to make the mobile home industry much safer and higher quality while maintaining its very low cost? And so HUD took some of the learnings from an Operation Breakthrough, one of them being that instead of having a prescriptive regulatory environment that tries to spell everything out in the code and then have people project by project, company by company fulfill that, move to a performance-based regulatory environment where you describe how something should work, but leave the actual specific assemblies, materials up to the industry. So they built a kind of performance code environment and then developed a sort of federal national standard. There had been an industry standard before that, which was not good enough. So HUD developed that for the mobile home industry, gave it back to them, and transformed it overnight with a wand into the manufactured housing industry, and really managed to do something kind of amazing, which is that maintain the affordability, but really increase the quality. And if there was a bump, the market share dropped from very high, from maybe 20% to lower, and then over, but then the manufactured housing industry grew much faster in the 70s and 80s than even typical construction. And for a certain segment of the US population, particularly low-income rural areas, where builders weren't even building, the manufactured housing industry provided units not just that were affordable but accessible, that just no one was building it. And today the percentage, the market share is less than 10%, but the cost saving is still there. And there's some Achilles heels that were built in during the negotiation. So because it's more difficult to get financing, although that's changed, and it's more difficult, and it's much easier to exclude manufactured homes using land use restrictions than the typical construction. That's always kind of been two Achilles heels for the industry. Nevertheless, what we like to do is, as with the research, is to point out that in the U.S. there is most of the building codes are still, we have model codes that then get adapted and changed into thousands of variants for most construction, whereas on the other hand, the HUD code is a national preemptive code, so all 50 states essentially use the same code. And I would say that the systematization of that code, more than the technology itself, is what brings that cost savings and maintains that quality.
Yes, and I just want to pull a thread there because I see in the last few years you've developed a real interest and taste in regulatory frameworks, and we're going to get into that. But this word that you just used, preemptive code, I just want to unpack that for a second because the way I've always thought about the HUD code is that effectively, what it's doing, and the innovation, I think, as you were saying, is that it sits as a separate track to approvals that can bypass perhaps many of the state and local rules, giving assurance, if you like, to, as you referred to it before, the sort of system certification. And therefore, it's fast-tracked in a very certain and low-risk way of producing living units. Is that a fair thing to say?
It partly is true. The only thing is, it's the difference, though, and it's part of the way that U.S. codes work, is that it's not so much industry. It has not been industry driven. HUD came in, they kind of reformed the industry. I think the biggest flaw, as opposed to what Operation Breakthrough wanted and what the Japanese have been able to do, and I think what Europe is going towards too, is that it's still a consensus-based code and consensus-based standards, which is just the way the US and I think other Anglo-Saxon societies like to do things, where instead of having standards evolve in the messy world of the market and then become referential at a code level, we tend to have a consensus discussion and come up with the least bad standard. And that hasn't kept innovation from really moving quickly. And when I say innovation, I don't mean, flying buildings or even 3D printing. I just mean like little improvements that actually can have a big impact. So that's where I think system certification, the way that Operation Breakthrough set it up, was industry driven, and the Japanese have adopted that, where it's really company by company. You can, you invest in the R&D, and your standard is now treated almost like an alternative mode of compliance, whereas the HUT code is still top down in that way. And I think that's where maybe some of its limits lie. It's just very hard. Its changes move, they move much more slowly than, for example, in Japan, their system really allows for industry and to pay for also all the R&D, and then to be rewarded by a fast track through the actual code permitting and inspection. The beautiful thing, sounds very Anglo-Saxon, but it for some reason doesn't play in Anglo-Saxon society so much.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, a ray of sunshine here. The Australian government has decided over the last 6 months or so that this is of grave importance to them, and that we are also embarking on such a system certification style process. We're not sure exactly where that will land at the moment, but the work has begun. And so it's an interesting thing, and I'll certainly be pointing many of our colleagues towards this interview in order to get some of that background. Final point from me, or just a question to see if you think this is correct. I read a research article, I think it was last year, that said 80% of the US's affordable housing is supplied through manufactured housing. Now, you just said that the market share is around about 10% at the moment, and I know the term affordable housing is fraught in many, many ways, but do you think that is actually a realistic figure, Ivan?
I don't, because I think a lot of, I mean, so 30% of US housing, for example, is multifamily. I don't know. I don't know if that sounds high to me, to be honest. I don't know how they're calculating it. It could be, I don't have that figure. I'll be honest with you. But I do think, though, whatever the statistic is, even looking at Soviet programs, on its own terms, the HUD code has been incredibly successful, and it's been incredibly cost effective. It has not caught, there's really not major public subsidies. The magic is in simplifying the, it's in the two things that we, highlighted in the reports. The HUD is it creates a as large of a possible harmonious regulatory environment, and it moves from prescriptive to performance. And that seems to be a global winning strategy for regulation. And if you can then do a third thing, which is to push, give opportunity for companies to do the R&D work, so you don't have to as a state, and then review that, that really works. And that has worked in very different political and cultural contexts, and it's delivered.
I mean, we shouldn't forget here, right? The landmark work by I believe his first name was Arthur Bernhardt, in his massive book that sets out, the successes and trials and tribulations of the mobile slash manufactured housing industry, and I think the regulatory part is definitely one of the major pillars of that, but the ability of that industry to set up a complete production, distribution, transportation, and land use system is something that has been unrivaled, as far as I'm aware, in any other program in any other country, certainly in the last 100 years. So I think it's a fascinating case study that we probably can't do justice to today. But let's get now a bit more into the work that you've been doing, which includes reviewing many of the things that we've just been speaking about, as we said, but I'm just going to lay out a bit of a timeline and then we'll walk through some of these things. So, as I understand it, your first piece of work has been the research roadmap, which we'll get into in a second. And then there's been some additional work more recently around certain action plans that relate, no doubt, to some of the points pointed out in the research roadmap. And then even moving to suggest certain regional pilots and things of that nature. Is that a fair scope, Ivan, or have I missed anything in that?
That's right. Yeah, and I think we, the weirdly again, the historical research has proven to be really helpful because between the research roadmap and the action plans, really we try to develop what we're calling a conceptual model for effective government-led acceleration of offsite construction for long term. But really, what has been, if we need government action in this, what does that look like when it's successful? And that was the transition from the roadmap, which looked at really barriers to the recommendations for a federal and then now for regional action plans, really doing this kind of transition from the historical work that we both like to do into kind of almost advising work and trying to develop a model that says what has really worked, particularly in the last 50 years, by so what government actions have actually been cost effective and really had an impact on supply, on affordability, on quality, on performance.
Yeah, I just want to underline what you just said there, Ivan. I think that is so important for those of us who work in this space. You might say the level of institutional memory, or another way to put it, perhaps less kindly, would be sort of amnesia about what's been done before, what worked, what didn't work, and then taking those lessons or challenges into the future is something that we see everywhere. It's not limited to Australia or the USA or any other country, and so I couldn't agree more with what you just said. But returning to your research roadmap, I just want to spend a bit of time on that because it's well, first, let me just say it's a fantastic piece of work. You and your contributors deserve an immense amount of praise, and obviously we'll have a link to the report, which is publicly available on the HUD website. That'll be incorporated in the show notes. Great piece of work. The report sets its task as the analysis, and I quote, "key knowledge gaps and research needs to overcome the barriers and challenges of offsite construction," exactly as you just said. So before we get into that, I just want to bring in a little bit more context as well, Ivan, to say how much housing in the USA currently would you say is offsite?
Well, it's just the challenge with measuring because the manufactured housing sector is very well documented. But outside of that, then there are other flavors. So there's volumetric modular, and then there's two different ways to calculate it based on the number of units or based on market on the value, sort of like pre-manufactured value, what the UK uses. And so that could be a couple of percentage points. It could be 4 percentage points. I don't know. It's just the problem is we don't have good metrics. So, and then there's really a lot of different panelized systems that in the US, like Australia and like, and like Northern Europe, there is a lot of the core form of construction is a panelized form of construction. They just do it on site. So it's very hard to say. I think it's, we could say it's less than 20% and it's more than 10% with confidence. So that's the best numbers, and we don't like guessing, but the fact that manufactured housing alone has hit a couple of peaks where it alone was 25% of market share is pretty.
So you roll effectively manufactured housing and some of those other types of prefabrication into one number. Is that?
I would,
Yeah.
but people don't like doing that because of the historic stigma of mobile homes. So
Correct.
even because there were so many mobile homes built before the manufactured housing code
Yes.
that they're still out there and they are not adequate for people to live in. And so while so that's there's a lot of cultural stigma, but in reality, the US volumetric modular industry grew out of the manufactured industry. In fact, the regulatory environments, even though they're different, also have connections. So yeah, we do we connect them because it's just true.
Yes.
But it's what's really what's harder to measure in the US and in other markets is the growth of kind of industrialization and prefabrication within what we would call conventional, and how much that's approaching these more value add process. It's very hard to measure. It's hard to measure that in Japan, by the way,
Yes. I
too.
mean, we just to give you some detail that underscores exactly what you've just said, Ivan, in Australia, we have exactly the same issue. We actually don't know what the market share is. And part of the reason for that, as you've already intimated, is because we actually don't have a definition. If we talk about volumetric modular, that's one set of counting, or as you just mentioned, pre-manufactured value is another set of measurement. And similarly, I recently learned that we have a concept of land lease communities here in Australia, which are similar in some respects to the manufactured housing communities where land is leased. And I recently learned that despite the fact that I think there's about 5,000 such units across Australia that have come up in the last 5 years or so, they're also not counted as housing, which just strikes me as very strange. People live in them, they live in them long term. These are not caravans that are being moved from day to day. So there's clearly a lot of work to be done on the metrics and the framing of some of these things and getting more data in this area. But what I'd like to discuss with you now, you in the report, you and your co-authors set out six different areas, and I'd like to get into that a little bit about what is holding the industry back. Just quickly, I'm going to race through these six areas, but those of you who've are so inclined will certainly get into this. The number one was the regulatory framework, no surprises given our conversation to date. Number two was standards and system performance. Number three, capital, finance, and insurances. Number four, project delivery and contracts. Number five, labor and workforce training and management. And finally, number six, business models and economic performance. Ivan, I feel like based on our conversation already, the regulatory framework is obviously top of mind for you, but maybe you could just give us some insights into what you discovered looking through that, and what would you consider to be the top three barriers?
Well, I mean, I came from my dissertation work, really, you could say it was project delivery because it's like, how do you actually design for manufacturing assembly, right? So that was always a big thing. And then I assumed early on in my career that was the big issue. Most folks coming in, we worked with industry and we worked with academics on that one, including some international folks. So there was a technical committee put together. We were the project technical chairs. They all kind of focused on really finance, which of course is a big issue. We settled on regulatory as the key issue because the regulatory piece actually, you could say, just made all the other problems worse, and it informed. So insurance, contracts, even business models, everything was kind of built by the water within which you swim. And actually, we had even issues with talking to industry because they would rank regulatory lowest in terms of their barriers sometimes, partly because for many reasons that maybe I don't need to go into, but partly just because they were just so used to the barriers that the other ones seemed more obvious. So regulatory was a big one. And then we could find ways that it impacted. So project delivery, well, project delivery is influenced by contract. Contracts again are influenced by a regulatory environment that, for example, pushes decision-making towards the end, which I'm sure it does in Australia too. Since it assumes you're going to be doing it project by project, site by site kind of work. So yeah, we just kept both the comparative studies, countries where offsite construction not only grew, because who cares if it grew, but that achieved societal goals, they did all kinds of different things. It was the regulatory changes that really opened up the industry, even more so than direct subsidies, for example, which, sometimes governments seem more interested in doing that. So that's why we sort of settled in. But I mean, all six have, equal attention, but we sort of highlighted regulatory and finance as the two that needed the most attention. But I think even now we keep coming to particular aspects of the regulatory environment that just make everything else so much worse.
That's really interesting, and I'm guessing that the government policymakers who listen to this podcast will be very happy to hear you say that working on regulations can have more impact than subsidies alone. That's always a good, a well-placed point for the government coffers, which are obviously struggling to pay for all of the new housing that all of our countries need.
But you would think that, Matthew, maybe Australia is different, but in the US, we've had a hard time with that argument. People would rather give subsidies to industry than do the hard political work of changing the regulatory framework. It seems to be more, there seems to be more resistance. Even though it doesn't cost more money, it costs more political.
Yeah, well, I was excluding some of the political fallout that can come from changing a regulatory system. I was thinking dollar for dollar, making full houses.
Yeah, dollar for dollar, it's very
It's
cost
very
effective.
cost effective. And so certainly that's what we're seeing in Australia, a focus on that at the moment too. I find that really interesting too, the way that you break down, the kind of root cause rather than the symptom. Things when I first flipped through your report when we met or after we met in the US in February, I thought to myself, wow, this is almost a carbon copy of many of the issues that we've been down here working and advocating on as well. But I do like the way that you show how many of them are nested, if you like, around this regulatory framework. Moving now to some of the recommendations and solutions that you make in the report, which I also found very engaging and very hopeful as well, I should say, Ivan. So fantastic work there. I counted, I think, no less than 17 research recommendations for the industry, which I love because sometimes we go into these meetings, and I'm sure you've had this experience, and somebody wants to say, what's the one thing I need to do? What's the low-hanging fruit? And it's a difficult message to deliver that, sometimes I say just jokingly, well, you've got to do 12 big things simultaneously in order to turn this stuff around. So you've got 17, so I feel better about my 12. But the sort of 17 recommendations that you make for further research and development range from proposing, for example, demonstration projects, with which I would wholeheartedly agree, to establishing a data culture, to measure the industry, which is one of the problems we just discussed before. You also suggest an evaluation of the HUD code, which you and I have discussed as well today at length, and also developing that pathway for developing new products, which, lights my heart on fire when I hear you talk about that. So I think that's a fantastic list, and I want to get you to sort of add maybe more to your sort of view of what's really important in that list of 17.
Well, maybe, to help you, I think from the 17 in the research roadmap, we ended up with three for the recommendations for actions for the at the federal level in the US. So maybe I could, and those came from the 17. So if you want, I can maybe touch on those. So from that research roadmap, we moved to both studying HUD and three peer government agencies in the UK. And actually both in England and Scotland because they're different, and then in Sweden and then in Japan. I'm not going to get into that, but it came. We saw that there was a combination of there is so yeah, there was a combination of acceleration came from regulatory reform, which opened up the let's say pipes the flow could move faster, and then what we call demand aggregation, which was essentially some form of subsidy that had sped up. Through those pipes. So the regulatory, the blockage, and then the demand aggregation, pushing or pulling. And so the research for each of those actions, so each we looked at in the first step was saying, look, there's a lot of money being spent already in housing, but also in manufacturing job creation, in building performance, in preparing for natural resilience. So one of the things that came from the research roadmap and we thought was the lowest hanging fruit for our federal government, and I think it would be the same in Australia, is to look at every federal program, even ones you don't think directly touch on housing, and look at their or the award criteria, and make sure that they work for industrialized construction. And then, in even a more ideal world, look at those award criteria and see if you can standardize those award criteria to where innovative forms of construction can more easily compete for them. And this is really based on Japan. We've seen Japan spend very little and slowly move a number of their housing subsidy programs through one form of again, this term I'll define a little more clearly, system certification. So Japan started by essentially looking at how they distributed their mortgages and made little point reductions for housing products that met certain societal goals. And it's very elegant. It wasn't a lot of money. It was more signaling to the consumer that these were better products. And it was creating a not a fast acceleration of market demand for innovative construction, but a long and flat kind of even industry-friendly like pipeline. So you don't, I mean, growing offsite construction sector fast is about as good as, you know, not growing it at all, because it will eventually. Those companies will collapse. And that's just not the way industry works. And so Japan somehow, partly through intelligence, maybe partly through, you know, situation in history, they just found a way to sort of make this kind of even pipeline without getting too involved in the industry. And so that was our big, so all that research, and then actually that's what we, the one thing we haven't been able to publish, because I guess it was that good, was we really sat down with HUD and looked at every federal agency, Department of Energy, Department, U.S. Department of Agriculture, Department of Transportation, and said, what are all of their programs? How do they touch on housing? What are their criteria? How could we simplify those criteria to where just that money going out there would create more even pipelines? And that alone will create the conditions that are similar to Japan, particularly if we could also, the way that mortgages are distributed in the U.S. and the way risk for mortgages assessed, that's where Japan has just done such a great job of saying, look, we can assess almost for code compliance at the same time we can assess for whether the structure deserves a slight reduction in mortgages. And that has created such stability in their pipeline, which is why they have such a great sector.
Which, you know, for those of us who've spent a lot of time in this industry as well, if, you know, my impression is, if we go and ask many manufacturers, what do you need to grow your business or to be more stable, they'll say a stable pipeline or a larger pipeline. And so that really is the secret sauce here. Ivan, regulatory reform and harmonization, demand aggregation, you said there were three. What was the third one?
Well, so it's those are, no, those two working together. I think it was demand aggregation and regulatory reform. And you put the, I mean, and certainly there's sort of education of the sector, and but that's, that kind of happened. But I think from a, but those, the education piece, you know, government can be involved or industry can be involved, but the both, the two that government is absolutely necessary for are those two, demand aggregation. And we have three, there's demand aggregation, usually government, even in, you know, the most capitalist pro-business sectors, for whatever reason, seems to go directly to, you know, guaranteeing procurement, and that works. And then it doesn't. And then you turn off the spigot and those companies are gone every time. And what, you know, again, we love Japan because it looks like what you would think an Anglo-Saxon culture would do and never does, which is to say, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to look at all our subsidies. We're going to look at small but consistent, you know, rewards for good behavior, for adult behavior. And we're just going to do it for a long time. We're going to do it for 50 years. You know, and we're going to achieve seismic resilience that way. We're going to achieve aging in place that way. We're going to achieve accessibility that way. We're going to achieve circularity that way. And we're just going to, you know, you don't need a lot, but you need to be consistent. And that will create industrialization across the board. And that's been, so that was our first recommendation to HUD. Like, you know, if you want a silver bullet, you don't need a new technology. We don't think you should spend a lot of money, but you should look at the funds you're putting out there, and the funds other agencies are putting out there, and standardize their work criteria and make sure that they, you know, work well for industrialized construction, and you'll get a stable pipeline without even necessarily. Now you can put more subsidies out there if you want, and for lower income housing it's going to be necessary, but for growing the sector, we think that has been the gold standard. And countries like, so for example, Sweden went for more aggressive kind of procurement, and it worked, and then it didn't, and then they've gone back in a more pro-business way in the last 30 years and done something very similar to Japan. And it's that steady long-term commitment, you know, aligning those programs that has created that demand aggregation. And then the regulatory reforms have opened up the those pipes to allow for that flow. And that's worked, that's created sectors that don't need government intervention anymore.
Fantastic. So, to use your analogy further, no need for a bypass in that artery.
That's
You've
right.
got a smooth flowing regulatory framework, and you've got a steady and strong
Blood, the blood is
blood.
the demand. Yeah, that's
Yeah,
right.
great.
Yeah.
I want to move to wrap up, but I can't do that without bringing us back to some of your final sort of recommendations and work is around, I think, what you were terming regional pilots and just this the centrality of piloting many of these solutions and ideas. Ivan, how do you think about piloting some of these ideas?
Well, so, you know, I'll give you a specific example. We worked with before we even worked on with HUD, we worked with some nonprofits in Minnesota, and in particularly Minneapolis. So Minneapolis was one of the first cities to reform its zoning to allow for what we would call missing middle kind of housing in what were formerly single structure detached housing lots. And so we worked with an NGO there to kind of educate the construction design sector, help them set some goals, and then they worked with their one other a public housing authority to do a pilot project. The pilot project was there to show off that technology of offsite construction to do things that maybe it couldn't do. But what we really wanted them to do was through what again Taylor would call the laboratory method, so developing knowledge through doing, but also through research. We asked them to develop an RFP, request for proposals, that would not only that would create a level playing field, that would create rules for selecting teams where and conventional on-site builders and off-site builders could compete equally, and that what would be rewarded was innovation and integration, not just technology. And then, in our hypothesis was, if you do that, if your award criteria were good, you'll get a better result. And they did. And that, and but we could have, we had all the research, we did the research. It was important to do the research before you do the pilot project. Just doing an attempt, that's what an not an experiments require research. Otherwise, what in architecture, what we call experiments, really just attempt. Without research. So we did the research, we had a hypothesis, they were willing to try it out. They did the hard work. They had 12 different teams compete. The team was chosen based on the criteria. That team delivered cost, time savings, higher quality, less impact on neighbors, but it also helped them develop the real tool that came out of that was a set of new award criteria that you could use to really distinguish between different proposals, not from a technology perspective or aesthetic perspective, but from a kind of all of the things that are in the research roadmap perspective, the contracts, the business model, the things that really make technology work. And now it's really exciting because one of my two hometowns, Greater Boston, is about to do a pilot project, literally taking that RFP. And doing a 2.0 version of it. And I love that. I love the fact that it's not new. I love the fact that it's continuous improvement and the fact that they're saying we don't need to reinvent the wheel. And it's not about technology alone, it's about framing that technology. And they're in the fall, they're going to 12 city-owned sites, but this time deed restricted market rates. So we can prove out that yes, it can work in public housing, it can also work in the market. And it's really about asking people to act like adults and rewarding them for it.
That's excellent, Ivan. Is that research that's available publicly, the work in Minnesota?
So that's our new project. So we are literally building. So our most recent project for HUD, we haven't really published. Actually, there's going to be something maybe coming out, and I will send you a link
Please.
prematurely. But we are developing a handbook for HUD on how regions can do action plans and pilot projects. So there
Wonderful.
will eventually be that.
Well, and I think again, thank you so much for that, Ivan. I think you really hit on a point that we've been pushing for and advocating as well in some of the work and advocacy that we're doing is how do you reward innovation? How do you set up the regulatory environment that stimulates innovation? Because I think many would agree that it's very easy to get into a regulatory framework that is regulating for the lowest common denominator, but not allowing us to effectively exceed everyone's expectations. So it's a real question of how to do that. And I think in the work that you're showing there, you're doing that, and I think that's really to be commended. I do want to move to wrap up now, Ivan, with a couple of final questions. But before I do it, I'm also just very buoyed by the similarity between the work that you guys are doing over in the USA and the work that I and many of the others are doing down here in Australia. I don't often talk about that on the podcast, but to me, it's actually it recommends the solutions that we're all working on, because I think, as you say, we don't have to start from scratch. A lot of this stuff is in some respects not new, and it's about finding what works and replicating that. So I just want to acknowledge your work and also thank you for that. But just a couple of final questions, Ivan. I mean, you're obviously someone, as we've discussed today at length, that studied the history, theory, and practice of building. What, in closing, would you say that we should focus more on in building, or what perhaps in your view is not getting enough attention?
Well, I think everything is getting a lot of attention. That's great. I think one thing I've learned over the last couple of years, going from doing, from being an architect to being a sort of researcher to doing a PhD, in not in the right order, maybe, and then getting really focused on, things that really matter to me and maybe five other people. Maybe it's about how to be very clear and simple about how this matters to people. So we were fortunate to be joined by New York Times journalists on one of our trips for HUD to Sweden, and really a very smart person, researcher, but still explaining the nuances of building code and permitting and inspection and making those really clear, like why does it matter to you and why does it matter to your life? So I think all of us doing really interesting research, I just think, the clearer you can make it, and the more relevant you can make it to a broader number of people, the better. And so I think, I'm amazed. I was recently at, again, an event in Berlin looking at research around how the species of wood are going to change because of climate adaptation, how that's going to change the wood industry, which is going to change housing. And I love that, rigor and research. And I was thinking, how are you going to tell this to the average German or Swede or American, Australian? How does that matter to them? So how do we communicate to people and really make them care about these topics is, I think, what, keeps me up at night.
Excellent, Ivan. That's a fantastic perspective. Final question is the good old crystal ball question, which is, and I know that you will have thought a lot about this. What do you think is coming down the pipeline in the building industry in the next 5 to 10 years, and how does that future look in your mind?
Well, I mean, I'm hopeful that I do think buildings are going to be treated a lot more like building products. I think there's going to be a convergence. I think in the European Union, it's already happening. The shift to a performance building code in the European Union has been matched by what I call a common nutritional label for building products. So since 2010,
That's fantastic. Yeah.
it's I think that's the biggest. We were so excited about like understanding the Euro code as a performance-based code and what it does, and then we're like, well, there's way too many pages, there's way too few pages here compared to, building regulations in the rest of the world. And then we realized, well, it's because all the building products have been reassessed to where they're much easier to mix and match, and so building products that became clear. And there's a blurriness between building products, building assemblies, and buildings, and I think that's the European Union has led. It's taken them 50 years, and I think I know Australia and Canada are looking at this. New Zealand is maybe even further along, and I think we will in the US and other countries will be moving in that direction too. So it'll become, which doesn't mean that buildings will, in fact, it doesn't mean buildings will become more repeatable or standardized. It means that the building products are becoming more flexible, buildings are becoming a little more standardized, and there's a kind of blurriness between the two, and that makes thinking about circularity, that makes thinking about carbon accounting a lot easier. And I think that is a hopeful future. I think there's other futures where we don't do much and we don't address any of the issues that we want to address. But I'm hopeful that that's the way it's going to go. And I've seen it. And countries like Sweden, we're going to be doing a webinar very soon about their new building code, which is very exciting, that are showing what's possible when you really simplify the regulations and really encourage innovation.
Fantastic, Ivan. I love your last two answers. They've been very different to many of the answers we've had on the podcast previously. So, sort of underlining what it is about the work you do that matters to people, and then looking at this future view of the industry that's an industry of products rather than an industry of handcrafting buildings out of raw materials,
That we
strikes
don't
me
have
as a
anymore.
very exactly that are rapidly diminishing. And I don't mean to be flippant about that. Ivan, that's been fantastic. To our audience, I hope we've delivered on our promise that the conversations we have are always fascinating and insightful. I always learn so much, Ivan, when I talk to you, and I really appreciate that. I appreciate the work you and your colleagues are doing over there. So thanks again for your time today. For our audience, I really hope that our conversation has delivered today. It's always fascinating to talk to Ivan. I think you get a sense of the length and breadth and depth of Ivan's knowledge, and I really appreciate the fantastic work that Ivan and his colleagues are doing in the USA. So many thanks again, Ivan, for your time today. And as always, for our audience, notes and references will be added online as part of our show notes. And thank you for listening. And Ivan, thanks once again.
Thank you, Matthew.